Well, good afternoon. My name is Doris Meissner, and I'm a senior fellow here at the Migration Policy Institute, where I direct our work on U.S. immigration policy. I'm very pleased to welcome you here to MPI's Leadership Visions series and to our time with Alan Berson, the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection. Leadership Visions is a speaker series that creates an opportunity for the Washington immigration community and others to meet with and hear from senior officials who have important immigration policy and organizational portfolios about their work and particularly about their plans for where they are steering their agencies in the period ahead. Our prior speakers have been John Morton, the Assistant Secretary for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Then we had Alejandro Mayorkas, who is the Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. We've also had as a guest Alex Alenikoff, who is the Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva. And you can check out all of those prior appearances on podcasts and videos that are posted on our website, www.migrationpolicy.org. This one is there, too. It's being live streamed, and that leads me to ask you all to please turn off your cell phones at this point. But what we do in this series is that we really do use the time for kind of three parts. First, we will have formal remarks from the commissioner. Secondly, the commissioner will join me on the podium, and he and I will have a conversation for some while. And then the third part will be to turn to you, the audience, and give the opportunity for questions and answers. So with that, let me now turn to our guest speaker and to an introduction of him that gives you some ability to understand the background that he brings to this position. Alan was appointed to the commissioner's position in March of 2010, so he's still probably in his just about first 6 months, I think is fair to say, maybe sneaking over that a little bit. But he's responsible for an agency whose mission is far-reaching and really very difficult, because the mission is to protect our nation's borders while facilitating legitimate trade and travel. As most of you, of course, know, CBP as an organizational entity is relatively new in that it was created in 2003 as part of the creation of the Department of Homeland Security and is an amalgam of key organizational pieces of the former Immigration and Naturalization Service along with key organizational functions from the former United States Customs Service. So the point, of course, was that in a post-9/11 era, there needed to be more coordination and seamlessness in our border protection, border enforcement efforts, and that's the purpose and the background for CBP. In shouldering the responsibility for leading this agency, Alan brings really unique skills and perspective because he's been there before. In the mid-1990s, he served as United States Attorney in San Diego, and as part of those responsibilities, began to work on border enforcement issues, but then quite quickly became the Attorney General's Southwest Border Representative, a.k.a. Border Czar. That was under Janet Reno, and as a result, he and I got to know each other well. We worked together very closely, very intensively at that time. And I think it's fair to say that that really was the time where the modern border buildup as we know it, and more importantly, perhaps, the consciousness about border enforcement as we understand it today really began. So it's really a special personal pleasure for me to be able to host him and have him here today as our guest. And I can attest in hosting him that this is a man who knows the border well. This is somebody who knows border communities on both sides, who knows officials on both sides of the border. He is a seasoned law enforcement professional. He's hard driving. He's indefatigable. He has an incredible work ethic. He is somebody that is not afraid to rock the boat. He is a great partner with whom to work. So our relationship was one that makes me extraordinarily glad not only to welcome him here today, but to see him back on the case with the portfolio that he has now in this administration. Since that time in the 1990s, as you can see in more detail from the bios that are on your chairs, he's, of course, worn many hats. He's been the superintendent of public schools in San Diego, which is the eighth largest urban school district in the country. He's served as the Secretary of Education for the state of California. He's been the chairman of the San Diego Regional Airport Authority. He's done lots of other things. So he brings all kinds of skills and perspectives to this position. But I don't think that I'm speaking out of school in saying that in being in the job that he's in now, he's in many ways really returned to his first love, which is law enforcement. And to that, he brings exceptional credentials and experience. He travels a lot. He's just back from Dubai, so trying very hard to stay awake with the time changes. So I'm very, very pleased that we were able to work out a schedule that allowed him to be here with us, because we really are looking forward to having the opportunity as the Washington immigration community to know you better, Alan, and for you to know us better. So with that, I'm very, very pleased to welcome you, and I ask everybody to please join me in welcoming him to the podium.
Thank you, Doris. Actually, the way my friend and wife, Lisa Foster, puts it is that I've now taken my fourth left turn, and I'm back where I began. So I'm particularly happy to be here with all of you at the Migration Policy Institute, particularly with Doris Meisner. If the as she indicated, the era of modern border management and control began in the early 90s, when in fact it did. It was Doris Meisner, who was commissioner of the INS at that point, was the person at the forefront who led the effort to restore the rule of law to the U.S.-Mexico border, an effort that has continued and on which I'd like to give you a update report in the course of this presentation. I'm going to do something I don't characteristically do, which is to refer repeatedly to a set speech, but I promise not to be bound by it, and look forward particularly to questions and answers that we have in the dialogue. What I'd like to do is discuss the priorities in connection with Customs and Border Protection, which, as Meisner indicated, is in the wake of 9/11 and the Homeland Security Act of 2003, implemented in the first quarter of 2004, the first consolidated border management agency that brought together immigration admissibility and customs review into one agency. Australia has that. Britain has a form of that now. Other agencies over time, I think, will move toward seeing immigration, customs, and I should add a third legacy agency was agriculture that was put in for inspectional purposes in CBP. But this is the direction in which border management is moving, and we are attempting to perfect the merger, so to speak, at CBP. And what I'd like to do is talk about the priorities that our leadership team has set for this particular chapter in an agency that is now just over 6 years old. I'd also like to be specifically address the role of border security in the administration's efforts to resolve our broken immigration program. Let me begin with the seven value propositions, the seven principles that we have set forth to guide CBP's efforts both to secure our country and to expedite illegal trade and travel. First, targeting our enforcement efforts is the key to a safe nation. Since its creation in 2001, the National Targeting Center, and we have two located in Herndon, Virginia, the National Targeting Center for Cargo and the National Targeting Center for People and Passengers, looking at our function of protecting the American homeland by keeping dangerous people and dangerous things, people and passengers, goods and cargo, away from the American homeland. The National Targeting Center has become a critical tool in ensuring the safety and the security both of cargo and of passengers. One of the failures noted in the 9/11 Commission report was our inability to connect the dots, to harness disparate pieces of critical information to prevent terrorist attacks. The National Targeting Center, both for cargo and for passengers, has increased our capacity in this critical area and is producing results. The database capacity is astounding, and the search engines available to review the data equally impressive. The NTC, for example, played an important role in the capture of Faisal Shahzad, the attempted Times Square bomber. Targeting and risk management are crucial to our counterterrorism efforts and ultimately to a safer nation. To raise our capabilities to the next level, we are refining our targeting with real-time information and increasing our partnerships with other countries and with other agencies in the United States government. Accurate targeting is essential to facilitating legitimate travel and commerce. It allows our officers to focus law enforcement resources where they are most needed, on that relatively small percentage of people and goods that pose a threat to the country. Think about our challenge in terms of keeping dangerous people and dangerous things away from the homeland and enlisting both space, geography, and time, doing this as early as we can before people or cargo come to our juridical line, our physical border. Think of it as trying to find a needle in a haystack, because in fact, 99-plus percent of all cargo and people who approach our homeland actually are engaged in legitimate trade or legitimate travel. So finding the risk, the high-risk person or the high-risk cargo is akin to finding a needle in a haystack. And there are two ways that you can locate a needle in a haystack. Either you have very specific intelligence that permits you to go specifically into the haystack and pull out the offending needle, so to speak, or you can reduce the size of the haystack. So in fact, you do that by distinguishing between risks and by segmenting traffic between those cargo and people about whom and which you know something from those about which you have derogatory information or about which you have insufficient information to make a judgment. But when you do that segmentation, if you've identified enough of the trusted travel and the trusted cargo, you separate out the haystack and you focus your resources inspectionally on the remaining people and passengers, cargo and goods about which you do not have sufficient information to make a judgment to facilitate, to expedite their movement across the physical border. Over the next few months, we'll continue to make a major effort to enhance our ability to identify potentially dangerous shipments or individuals entering the United States. This means perfecting our search engines and increasing the amount of data against which we can search and make judgments about people and passengers. This also involves strong partnerships, as I indicated, with foreign nations and also with agencies in the United States as well as state and local agencies. So we're working to develop strong partnerships and coordination with, particularly now with the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, on civil aviation, and creating new partnerships with several agencies, including the Drug Enforcement Administration, as well as our traditional relationship with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, having to do with drug trafficking and other immigration customs offenses. Second goal, to secure the flow of people, cargo, and goods is key to CBP, and I would argue DHS's success generally. Border enforcement is not just a matter of protecting a juridical line. Instead, our goal is to look at the border as a matter of securing flows of people and goods, cargo and things, as far away from the border and as early as we can. We see securing the flow of goods and people as being the essence of border management, as opposed to the traditional view of waiting for this traffic to approach you at a port of entry, airport, seaport, a land port of entry, and doing the inspection for the first time at that port. The sooner we can make an assessment of security threats, the sooner we can focus on those things and people that we have to inspect most intensively at the border. And thereby, we can engage in the risk segmentation that, as I've indicated, is essential to the modern border management theory of managing risk. We don't open up every trunk at the border. We don't inspect every one of the 12 million containers that come into our ports, but we do so based on risk assessments and on targeting using data and using search engines that permit us to translate threat streams into searches in our databases. The other key point of securing flows is this trusted shipper and trusted traveler program. If we're able to identify low-risk travelers and cargo, we concentrate our resources accordingly. Our trusted traveler program with regard to aviation, global entry, which I hope and expect each of you should take advantage of, is growing at a rapid rate. Since we began, we have admitted 77,000 people into the program in just under a year, and we expect to be at 100,000 at the close of this calendar year. And it is a program which permits you to come into the airport and go immediately to a kiosk, do a 10-print fingerprint identification, working with U.S. Visit, and then you are asked to make a customs declaration on a keyboard, and then you are expeditiously able to leave the airport without further inspection except on a very randomized basis. This program takes its place alongside Sentry from the mid-1990s, which Doris Meisner introduced into international travel on the southern border with Mexico, as well as Nexus on the northern border with Canada, and FAST, a commercial program that permits certain drivers to register as trusted drivers of trucks on the U.S.-Mexico and U.S.-Canadian borders. This involves enhancing our relationship with U.S. Visit, and we will continue to do that in order to establish biometric identity. Third, and very importantly, as a key goal for CBP, securing key hotspots along the southwest border is critical. As INS's former director, Doris Meisner, knows well that our border security efforts in the 1990s were centered on operations such as Hold the Line, beginning with Silva Reyes in El Paso in 1993, and Gatekeeper, led by Gus de la Vina in San Diego in 1994, where we deployed additional agents and equipment to key locations along the U.S.-Mexico border. Over the past 20 months, we have taken that concept global by adding unprecedented resources, including personnel, technology, and infrastructure to the border according to intelligence and operational needs, sector by sector. These enforcement efforts, at and between the ports, have shown progress. For example, in fiscal year 2010 that just ended, total Border Patrol apprehensions along the southwest border were just over 463,000, a reduction of almost 17% from fiscal year 2009, and down 57% from the level of approximately 1.1 million in 2004-2006. Just as efforts by criminal organizations to exploit our border have cost, caused us to adapt our strategy, our unprecedented commitment of resources have led these same transnational criminal organizations to adapt theirs. Today, the area that remains our greatest challenge is the Tucson sector, that corridor from Hermosillo, Sonora, through Magdalena, to Nogales, Sonora, Nogales, Arizona, Tucson, and Phoenix. Through that corridor, almost half of all illegal entries occurring across the 260 miles of the border in this sector are occurring, and traffickers believe they can use the inhospitable terrain to evade authorities. Just under half of all of the marijuana smuggled into the United States comes through that same corridor. To combat these threats, we have concentrated our attention on decreasing criminal activity and illegal immigration in that area, the Tucson sector, from Hermosillo through Sonora, through Nogales, through Tucson and Phoenix. Surge enforcement efforts into the Tucson sector have allowed us to deny terrain being exploited by transnational criminal organizations. Significant shifts of technology into the Tucson sector have resulted in increased detection capability along the international boundary in the Tucson sector. We are reducing the draw for migrants attempting to illegally enter the United States through Sonora and Arizona. Congress recently responded to the President's call to bolster border security supplemental funding that will allow us to increase and improve our efforts to secure the border. In signing the Southwest Border Security Bill, President Obama added to the already unprecedented personnel, technology, and air assets in the Tucson sector of Arizona and along the rest of the Southwest border. This was the addition of 1,000 additional Border Patrol agents, 250 additional Customs and Border Protection officers, two additional unmanned aerial vehicle systems, as well as additional ICE agents and additional agents and U.S. Marshals in the Department of Justice. In the coming months, we will work to secure the necessary funding to permanently maintain these augmented funding and staffing levels. Fourth objective, implementation of a northern border strategy and the development of a maritime strategy on the littorals, the coast areas, are key to continental security and safety. Each border, northern, southern, or maritime, has its own characteristics and challenges, and we must tailor our approach to meet the unique threats, challenges, and opportunities presented not only north and south, which we've done along the Canadian-U.S. border and the U.S.-Mexican border, but also the littoral, the maritime borders from Maine to Miami and from Seattle to San Diego. Strengthening our cooperation with Canada, just as we have with Mexico, is critical to protection of the homeland. Last month, we engaged with Canada's Customs and Border Services Agency on our vision of perimeter security on the continental scale. We've also reached out to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to discuss ways to deepen our collaboration along the border between the ports of entry. These engagements have given rise to a series of specific bilateral initiatives covering such disparate issues as watch listing, binational consultation on ports of entry, land cargo preclearance, and joint operations between the ports of entry. Equally important, as I indicated, is the development of a CBP strategy for securing our coastlines, essential for homeland security over the long term. CBP and the Coast Guard closely coordinate on maritime unmanned aircraft systems and work together to identify and address requirements, including sensors, command and control, data exploitation, logistics, and training. Fifth goal, and connected to the development of particularly of a littoral strategy in concert with the Coast Guard, the unmanned aerial system, the so-called UAV, is key to America's situational awareness. CBP has the largest civil air force in the world, including both rotary and fixed-wing aircraft, and our Predator Unmanned Aerial Systems, or UAS. The U.S. gives us an aerial perspective that nothing else can and plays a key role in border operations. It's an essential platform for vigilance and situational awareness. Secretary Napolitano recently announced Predator flights out of Corpus Christi, Texas. With the deployment of a UAS in Texas, DHS unmanned aerial capabilities now patrol the entire southwest border from the El Centro sector in California all the way to the Gulf of Mexico in Texas, providing critical aerial surveillance assistance to personnel on the ground. Together with our technology laydown on the border, mobile surveillance systems, remote video surveillance systems, recon, three devices available to our agents, we begin to see a suite of technology that will permit us to detect and to respond to incursions on the border. I believe that UASs are a critical part of the future of border security efforts for this reason. We need to fully integrate their capabilities to support our officers and agents, while also standing ready to provide these assets when they're needed for other purposes, whether it's disaster response, as was the case in floods in North Dakota 2 years ago, or whether it was helping the Coast Guard and national authorities to monitor the Gulf spill that's just been successfully resolved in the Gulf. Sixth goal, trade is key to an economically prosperous and competitive country. While much attention has been paid to CBP's border security mission, it's important to recognize that international trade is as much a matter of national security as keeping terrorists out of our country. Trade and security are in many ways linked and equally deserve our attention. Promoting economic prosperity in this country and maintaining North American economic competitiveness is a dimension of national security to which we must attend. We're committed to strengthening our relationship with our trade and business partners and are working even more closely with the trade community to expedite legal trade, protect intellectual property rights, ensure import safety, and enforce trade laws that protect American businesses. We're also reaching out to the trade community itself to solicit their input and their reaction to a variety of initiatives that have been commenced. This month, for example, we will present the trade community with a preliminary proposal for creating industry-specific centers of excellence and expertise to deal with various industries, pharmaceuticals, electrical products, oil and gas, and textiles. We will also present a preliminary proposal to create an industry-specific account executive who will have both facilitation and enforcement duties. Traditionally, the way we've handled our customs responsibilities is on a line-by-line treatment of imports and exports. We import into this country $2 trillion worth of products a year. We export $1.8 trillion. Traditionally, we've handled this transaction by transaction. What we have to do is move toward an account-based management of our imports and then our exports. This is a fundamental transformation in our relationship with the private sector, one that significantly enhances supply chain security, improves enhancement of trade laws, and expedites legitimate commerce. It's an important step and one that we will be conducting on a pilot basis so that we can react organically and make mid-course corrections as we have to, as we effect this transformation in the way in which we handle business at the nation's borders. Seventh and finally is a proposition that our leadership team has proposed to our agency and to the nation, is that improving and expanding information infrastructure, technology partnerships, and human capital are key to accomplishing our mission. One of the most recent examples of improvement in these areas is the creation of the Office of Technology Innovation and Acquisition, that will help us better integrate, manage our technology and acquisition. It is no surprise, and it is something that we are working very hard to correct, that CBP has been engaged in several large-scale technology integration projects, whether SBINet on the southwest border or the automated commercial environment with regard to trade and commerce that have not been produced on time or on budget. We need to work to implement and integrate these efforts and improve our delivery, and we are endeavoring to do that in a systematic fashion. We expect OTIA, the Office of Technology, Innovation, and Acquisition, under Assistant Commissioner Mark Borkowski, to ensure that all of our technology efforts are properly focused and are better performed, and that the integration and the promise of technology is delivered to our functions. These seven principles are near-term goals that build on our previous achievements. Since CBP was created in 2003, we've accomplished a great deal both to secure our borders and to keep them open for business in a time of transition and tumult. We've added more Border Patrol agents and CBP officers. We now have more than 20,000 Border Patrol agents in between our official ports of entry and more than 20,000 CBP officers at our ports of entry. I think about Operation Gatekeeper in December of 1994 when Commissioner Meisner had something just around 3,000 Border Patrol agents. We've increased that sevenfold and very dramatically in the last year and a half. We've doubled the personnel assigned to border enforcement security task forces working with Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. We've tripled the number of intelligence analysts along the border since Secretary Napolitano announced the Southwest Border Initiative in March of 2009. On our northern border, we have established five air wings to assist in responding to incursions. The northern border is 5,400 miles of terrain and maritime environment. The southern border is just under 2,000 miles on the land border. As I've mentioned, we've deployed UAS unmanned aerial systems on both borders, and we've secured funds for 11 new Marine units, six of which are on the northern border. We've upgraded many of our ports of entries to meet today's security standards and to house tomorrow's technology. We've expanded the Trusted Traveler programs from Sentry on our south, Nexus on our north, Global Entry in our airports, and the WITI initiative on the southern and northern borders with Mexico and Canada. We've also created a Trusted Shipper program with our partners in trade, the Customs Trade Partnership Against Terrorism. Just under 10,000 companies worldwide have enrolled in this Trusted Shipper program. We need to update it, modernize it, and deliver security and trade facilitation at once. With our international partners, we've created the Container Security Initiative to secure maritime containers bound for the U.S. We've worked to get the international community to adopt the World Customs Organization Framework of Standards, which further expands our security and facilitation strategy to the global shipping lines. On our southern border, we've completed more than 600 miles of fencing, fencing recommended by the Border Patrol based on the circumstances in each of the sectors from Brownsville to San Diego. We've added more technology, including infrared and seismic sensors, video surveillance, and mobile systems. We've also strengthened our partnerships across the board with private industry, with other federal, state, local, and tribal law enforcement agencies, with other countries, particularly with our North American neighbors, Mexico and Canada. We're working more closely than ever before with Mexico to stop the illegal movement of drugs, bulk cash, guns, and human trafficking. As a result of this, and in ways I hope and trust we will explore in the dialogue to follow, it is, as the French poet said, a challenge of our times is that the future is not what it used to be. The relationship with Mexico was of the kind that we practice daily on the southern border was unthinkable even 3 to 5 years ago. As a result of all these activities, it is true that the southern border is more secure today than it's been in decades. That, in fact, judged by any objective standards such as the FBI crime statistics, the southern border is also safer. as someone who has lived and worked on the border and whose family remains on the border, in fact, in places like San Diego, in El Paso, Phoenix, and in most of South Texas, the border is safer than it's ever been. That does not mean that we do not have incidents of violence attributable to organized criminal activities based in Mexico. We do. But in fact, given the resource base that we have and given the partnerships that have been created, there has been no time in American history where the border has been more secure and in which the communities have been safer. That does not mean that there are not threats. There are. There always are. This does not mean that there is not significant additional work to be done. There is, and we will continue to pursue it. But we need to maintain a proper perspective on where we are as we work toward comprehensive immigration reform. For all we've accomplished, our country has yet to grapple with this issue of immigration reform that is integral to who we are as a people and how we are perceived as Americans by our neighbors and by people around the world. We all know the debate over immigration reform in recent years has been contentious, but heated debates aren't an excuse for inaction. Both Republicans and Democrats can agree that the immigration system is badly broken and that the status quo is unsustainable. That's why President Obama is fiercely determined to stop kicking the can down the road and once and for all to have an honest discussion, a conversation, a debate among Americans over the long simmering issues surrounding immigration. Let me provide some historical perspective. During the years of Presidents Clinton and Zedillo, for the first time, policymakers acknowledged the reality that Mexico and the United States, as nowhere else in their bilateral relationship, carry equal weight at our shared border. Serious and substantial efforts at transborder cooperation on a variety of fronts, beginning with law enforcement, led to a sovereign debate of unprecedented candor. Doris Meisner played a central role in initiating this era of serious discussion with Mexico, both in the civic and private sector as well as the government sector. For the first time, the United States and Mexico talked seriously and publicly about their mutual situation. The Clinton and Zedillo discussions deepened between Presidents Fox and Bush on both personal and political levels. The nations discussed the notion of emigration from Mexico and immigration into the United States as an appropriate subject for bilateral agreement. But the events of 9/11 brought this discussion screeching to a halt, and all efforts turned to securing the border. With the inauguration of Felipe Calderon and the election of a new U.S. president in 2008 came the prospect for resuming constructive discussions. This past May, as part of the second state visit of the Obama administration, Presidents Obama and Calderon articulated the vision for this era, the creation of a 21st century border, one that enhances our security and mutual economic competitiveness in an increasingly globalized world. The presidents emphasized that both the United States and Mexico have a shared responsibility for addressing issues that arise along our common border, and that we must, quote, develop the border and manage it in a holistic fashion and in ways that facilitate the secure, efficient, and rapid flows of goods and people and reduce the cost of doing business between our two countries. Underlying this new vision is a paradigm shift, a change in how people view the border. Historically, governments have approached border management as essentially holding the line, but the border isn't an isolated place disconnected from the interiors of Mexico and the United States. What we do at the border has effects that are felt far away from the jurisdictional line, especially in an era of international trade and global supply chains. And conversely, what happens in the interior has an enormous effect at what transpires at the border. Although policing the line will remain a key element of any border management approach, we must shift our thinking and take a more holistic view of border management, one, as I indicated before, that is based on the concept of securing flows of trade and travel, of people and goods, as they move across the globe and as they approach our homeland. The traditional understanding of border management, trying to find a balance between security and facilitation, does justice to neither security nor facilitation. On the contrary, if we look to secure the flow of goods and people, we can both secure and expedite commerce and travel simultaneously. This is a change that I've had in my own thinking since the time that I worked with Doris on the Century program in San Diego, Tijuana in the 1990s. Even then, we looked at security and facilitation as being mutually exclusive, if not in direct contradiction of one another. And we used to talk about the need to balance security and facilitation on the notion that it was a zero-sum game, that if we had more security, we would have less facilitation, and vice versa. I actually believe that this is a false dichotomy and an inadequate way to approach the challenges we face. And as I indicated earlier in my remarks, the notion of risk management, traffic segmentation, the idea of making trusted travelers and shippers, the haystack smaller, means that, in fact, we need to facilitate lawful commerce and trade, the movement of lawful travelers, in order to enhance our security profile, so that the two are actually not even two sides of a single coin, but properly practiced and implemented, they are the same phenomenon. We move lawful traffic and people, and that gives us a better ability to actually identify the risky traveler or the risky cargo. So as we approach the notion of secured flows and we look at the role of immigration reform in creating the environment, what are the elements? What are the elements that will create for the first time a legitimate labor market between the United States and Mexico? Three necessary elements. For far too long, the debate over immigration has been dominated by those who argue, on the one hand, passionately for a mass amnesty, or even that we should ignore the law and the books, and those on the other side who argue that we should round up and deport the 11 million illegal immigrants estimated to be living and working in the shadows of this country. The fact of the matter, both politically and as a question of sound policy, is that neither mass amnesty nor mass deportations are where the majority of Americans stand. What the American people agree on is that every side has to be held accountable. Common sense, comprehensive immigration reform has to be grounded on the principles of accountability and on the principle of responsibility. Responsibility from the federal government to secure our borders, a responsibility that CBP takes seriously and works every day to fulfill, to provide a system that does so that employers can rely on a lawful and legitimate workforce. Responsibility from employers so that unscrupulous companies don't exploit undocumented workers and gain an unfair advantage over those who follow the rules. And thirdly, responsibility from those who are here illegally so that they can register, admit to having broken the law, pay a fine, pay back taxes, get right with the law, and learn English before they can get on that long road towards citizenship if they choose to pursue it. When thinking through this type of common sense reform, I'm reminded of the words of the Spanish philosopher George Santayana, who said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." When we take up this topic again, and we must not repeat the mistakes we made in the 1986 IRCA, Immigration Reform and Control Act. That act provided a legal pathway for those who had entered illegally to regularize their status and to move to permanent residency or citizenship. But it did not confront illegal immigration. It did not create a mechanism by which we could deal successfully with future flows coming to the homeland. Ever since, the immigration debate has centered largely on control and enforcement, beginning with the quadrupling of the Border Patrol since the early 1990s. What is plain is that both approaches have failed to grapple with the central issue, labor supply and demand. Nor have they taken into account that neither enforcement nor normalization can succeed without appropriate coordination with the other policy. This is a package that goes together. We are now, as we have always been, a nation of immigrants. We are also a nation of laws. But the laws we have now are simply not sufficient for our 21st century needs. Just four years ago, a majority of Democrats and 11 of the Republicans who are still in the Senate today voted to move forward on that type of common sense immigration reform. It's the type of legislation we need now, and we can make that happen if we move past the false debates and start focusing on the long-term needs of our nation. We simply cannot afford to ignore these challenges because it may be good for the next election cycle. That's why the President has instructed DHS Secretary Napolitano to lead administration efforts to pass a comprehensive immigration reform law. DHS has worked with White House officials on this for more than a year and a half, in constant communication with key stakeholders around the country, including border community leaders, key members of Congress from both parties. And the President has supported several key steps toward reform, including the bipartisan framework Senator Schumer and Graham presented, as well as the outline presented by Senate Democrats and the bill recently introduced by Senator Menendez that tracks the bipartisan Schumer-Graham framework. Despite the refusal of some to step up to pass comprehensive reform, President Obama remains as committed to that goal as he's ever been. So here at the beginning of the 21st century, in an era of twinisms, globalism and terrorism, we find ourselves at a crossroads. We also find ourselves facing perennial truths. First, our immigration system is broken. Our immigration laws need to change, and change in significant ways. The current system isn't working for either the economy or for security. It's not working for our country. Creating an appropriate immigration framework must remain a priority for our nation's leaders. Second, we currently have immigration laws, and these laws can't be ignored. The law remains the law until it is changed, and our law enforcement officers and our agents are bound by duty and the law to enforce them. Third, we must enforce our laws in a serious and sensible way. That means we must employ a common sense approach to immigration enforcement. We should place our resources and allocate our time in those areas that give us the biggest return for our investment in terms of money and resources. We must focus on those who are here illegally and who are committing serious crimes, who present a clear and present threat to our communities. It also means that we must go after employers who are exploiting illegal labor, and we must streamline our system for applying for immigration status after having made good with the law. I know that Assistant Secretary of ICE John Morton and Director Alejandro Mayorkas, the USCIS, have spoken at MPI about what their agencies are doing to address these issues, and I appreciate the opportunity to share CBP's perspectives with you this afternoon. Let's also continue the conversation. I ask you to join us on a unique social networking site that's been set up at DHS focused on border affairs. It's at ourborder.ning.com. Ourborder.ning.com. www.dotning.com, where we find over 1,500 discussions outside of DHS, outside of the U.S. government, who have come together to address border issues in a systematic and conversational way. Please sign on at our border at Ning, on the Ning platform, and begin to contribute your insights and your perspectives to this critical national issue. I think we are at a point in which the challenge of our time is that the future is not what it used to be. The issue is whether or not we will meet that challenge by reacting properly to immigration reform as we continue to bring security to the border, whether we will continue to see a security and trade facilitation as being an identity, an interest that we can implement together and get the benefits both of a security and economic prosperity and competitiveness. It's a series of decisions that we've begun to take in the Obama administration and ones that I'm pleased to discuss with you this afternoon and to respond to your questions and to your comments. I thank you for this opportunity and look forward to the dialogue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very, very much. Well, Alan, you've covered a lot of bases. So the question is which points to pick up on, but I will try to cover as many as possible, and then, as I said to the audience, we'll turn to the audience. Let me begin with this point that you made about accountability and responsibility, and as part of immigration reform, when it happens, the responsibility to enforce our borders. That, of course, is so much of what is in the discourse, and there is quite a difference of view. I mean, there is the view that we cannot have immigration reform until our borders are secure, and then there is the counter view, which the administration has taken, that we can't fully secure our borders without a broader reform. So whichever side one is on where that is concerned, it still leaves the question of what is it that border control really is. So if we put the rhetoric aside of just porous borders, people getting through, how do you, in running this agency and in the broader discussion going on within DHS, actually define control of the border? What criteria, what does it look like?
I think there are two dimensions. First is safety, and we can, in fact, assess the safety of our communities on the border. And indeed, when we look at the crime situation in the southwest border, we begin to see that, according to FBI crime statistics, that the crime occurring on border communities is the lowest it's been in a generation. So we have this remarkable phenomenon of and it's reported on our borders on the Ning platform. You have mayors such as John Cook in El Paso, Jerry Sanders in San Diego, saying our cities are among the safest cities in the United States. El Paso, a stone's throw across the Rio Grande from Ciudad Juarez, right now arguably the most violent city in the Western Hemisphere, is the second safest city in America. So the first criteria is, are people safe in terms of traditional measures of public security and safety? The second is the extent to which the corridor is perceived by the community closest to it as being reasonably managed or out of control. You'll remember that when you began in the Clinton administration with Janet Reno and Gus De La Vigna, Operation Gatekeeper, in that first year, 560,000 illegal migrants were arrested in the San Diego sector alone. And we both know at that point probably twice as many were actually getting by enforcement efforts and moving into the country up the corridor toward Los Angeles. Over time, that has been reduced, so that this year, under 100,000 illegal migrants will be arrested in the San Diego sector. But that will represent a large majority of people attempting to enter illegally in that sector, and represent a large majority being apprehended by the Border Patrol in that sector. So if you talk to people in San Diego today, talk to my neighbors in San Diego, they will say the border is reasonably managed. The border is under control. The same thing has happened in the Yuma sector in Arizona, in El Centro, in Eastern California, and in much of Texas, including Laredo and Brownsville and McAllen. But El Paso is another a good case point when Hold the Line began in El Paso in 1993, 245,000 people were arrested trying to cross illegally from Juarez into El Paso. You know how many have been arrested in the El Paso sector in fiscal year 10?
I actually do know, but why don't you go ahead and tell us?
Well, just over 10,000. Just over 10,000. And of those 10,000, that represents, again, the large majority of people trying to enter illegally and the apprehension of all of those. So if 17 years ago, Doris, I had said to you that the number of people who would be crossing in El Paso and arrested would be 10,000, I don't know that either of us would have thought that that were possible, or that San Diego could be brought down to a level at which the community does not believe in any way that the border's out of control. So what we mean by border security means public safety and the sense in the community that the border is being reasonably and effectively managed. Absent comprehensive immigration reform, that's what border security means.
Well, that brings us to a couple points then. It brings us, first of all, to the question of the current job market in the United States and the recession, because the reduction in apprehensions is, as you've said, really dramatic. And especially dramatic in a couple of places along the border. But at the same time, we know that there has been, since the recession began, a real reduction in job demand. And so that really aids the, I mean, it's things that are working together. So if we see growth again, and if we see an increase in job demand, what would be your sense of what happens at the border?
Two points on that. First, yes, people say it's really the economy since the financial crash of 2008, the Great Recession now being alleviated from 2009, that it's really the economy that accounts for the decrease in apprehensions and the flow of persons. The fact is, if you look at the trend line, the steep decline began in 2000. In the height of the buoyant economy, that's when the numbers started coming down, and the slope has continued in that direction. So, yes, the economy has had an impact, but the trend and the direction of enforcement and the effects of enforcement actually have been established now for 10 years in this country. So when it's such that the only place on the U.S.-Mexico border where apprehensions are taking place at a triple-digit level, more than 100,000, is in the Tucson sector that I discussed from Hermosillo through Phoenix. The nature of the resources at the U.S.-Mexico border now, with 18,000 Border Patrol agents of the 20,500 that we have, with the number of CBPOs at the ports of entry, means that, in fact, when the pressure begins to mount again, when smugglers have groups starting to grow and they attempt to come back after the Christmas season. I expect that we will see the effort maintained, and that we will see greater success in the Tucson sector. And then our challenge will be to do what you and I have watched for 18 years, which is when you heighten an enforcement effort at this part of the border, the traffic moves east or west. So in fact, I described the numbers in El Paso and Tucson and San Diego. What we saw was a movement of the traffic west from El Paso and east from San Diego, and it being centered now in the Tucson sector. But when there is a displacement, if there is a displacement back to the flanks as a result of heightened enforcement in Tucson, the difference is that we are far stronger in the Yuma sector, in New Mexico, and in El Paso than we were as this movement during the 1990s, the first years of the 21st century saw it take place. We're a differently resourced border now, and when the traffic tries to move, I think that smugglers will find the border considerably less amenable to crossing than was the case in the past.
That has a lot to do, too, then, though, with technology and how technology plays into all of this. And one of the things you talked about was the somewhat checkered history of technology initiatives where the border is concerned. SBINet has been abandoned. A lot of money was spent on it. You're setting up a new office. But what's the technology vision for the border now? What role does it play, and what kind of technology?
I should say that Secretary Napolitano ordered a freeze on the SBINet. She will be in due course announcing an approach to the SBI situation. But generally, what we're looking at is the detection, the ability to detect attempted illegal crossings. And over time, you do that with a variety of devices based on the terrain that you face in a 1,900-mile border that differs considerably from sector to sector. But the theory of action is the same. Use a combination of radar and photography and video to be able to detect attempted entries along the border and to have your personnel deployed in such a way that you can respond efficiently and effectively to those efforts. And that theory of action has governed the efforts of border enforcement, will continue to do so. And as we perfect the ability to detect through the use of forward-looking infrared at night, and through greater coverage of radar and video and the use of sensors along the border, we will be able to more effectively deploy our agents to stop the attempted illegal entry.
Let me ask you about the optimum size, if there is one, of border efforts on the southwest border. I mean, I recognize, obviously, as you've well explained, that borders are much more, and border control is much more than simply the southwest border. But it is the southwest border that is in the news and that is in the political discourse as the real choke point politically, where immigration reform and other things are concerned. And when we can't do legislation, we seem to have one default that we can agree on in this political system, and that is more resources for border enforcement, largely southwest border enforcement. So now you have a new $600 million emergency appropriation, 1,000 more Border Patrol coming in on top of the 20,000. It's an $11 billion plus agency. How much is enough? Do we have a sense of what it takes and when we will be at the point where steady state would be the name of the game?
I think what we have to build into the Border Patrol, when we bring the Tucson sector into line with the rest of the U.S.-Mexican border in terms of both safety and security in the terms I've described, is to increase the agility and the flexibility of the Border Patrol that we have
so that we can react to changes in patterns of attempted illegal migration. I can't say with any specific degree of certainty until we face this new challenge of sustainability, when we've obtained a secure southwest border from Brownsville to San Diego, and we are maintaining and sustaining, I think we'll then be in a better position to say, how many more agents do we need? Remember, the three elements here are infrastructure, technology, and personnel. And I think you were right in your previous question to put a great emphasis on technology. We've increased the size of the Border Patrol seven times since you were the commissioner. Sevenfold. I can't say that we need number of agents. And I'm not even prepared to say that, another 1,000 or we're in the range. But we're certainly nearing in on that compared to where we were. But as I said, I think the key will be once we've reached a state where sustainability is the goal, we'll be able to make that judgment, offer that advice to the president and through him to the Congress and the American people.
Okay, let me turn to the floor and ask you to raise your hands and wait to ask your question until you have a mic so that we can hear, and please tell us who you are. Here?
I'm Stephen Dinan from the Washington Times. I'm wondering if, I know Border Patrol and GAO, I guess, use this term operational control. What percentage of the border is currently under operational control, and does that need to be 100% before Congress deals with comprehensive reform?
Yeah, the notion of operational control and then as control to managed and not under control is a judgment made about specific pieces of real estate. And as I understand it, because that was introduced after I had left and before I came back, it's a useful tactical notion that can be used by commanders in the field. And it's certainly an approach that we encourage our people to do when looking at their own sectors. I think it's less useful when you're talking about border security in the way in which Ms. Meisner asked about, well, how do you define a border control? So while I don't throw out that measurement, I don't think that it gives you the complete or even a completely useful view of this. I can't give you the specific tactical percentage that our commanders, our Border Patrol sector chiefs, would consider sector by sector. But, for example, talking about a operational control in San Diego and Otay Mesa is a completely different matter for talking about operational control in the sense in which you've used the term and that we've used it for the Big Bend in Texas. Very few people actually come through the Marfa sector in Big Bend. But on that tactical definition of operational control, we don't have operational control hundreds of miles that are in the Big Bend. So, it's one take to the problem, but not a completely not an exclusive one.
Next up,
Edwin Mora from CNSNews.com. The latest performance report by the Department of Homeland Security stated that by the end of fiscal 2009, there were approximately 939 miles under effective border miles under effective control. My question is there do you have a goal in mind to when the approximately 2,000 miles southwest border will be under effective control?
Well, this is a little bit like the same question that your colleague to your left just asked. You know, if you define it by the characterization of a piece of real estate, there are places on the border where it's not a useful characterization. And I have not seen, and nor have I developed my own estimate about when using that tactical definition, when a final end state will occur. I don't think that's a useful way to look at the border as an exclusive lens. What we have to look at the border is in terms of, as I suggested, public safety for our communities and the sense in which the border is being effectively managed. Absent comprehensive immigration reform, people will attempt to enter this country illegally, drawn by the job market. It is our job to stop them, and we will do our best to do that. We're doing better than ever before, but this is not about real estate. It's about flows of people and securing the border by deterring and preventing illegal immigration. Best way to do that is to have a legitimate labor market between the United States and Mexico. Absent that, we will manage the flows and protect the American people in terms both of public safety and in terms of effectively managing the border.
Okay. Is there another? Jack here?
I think back to the 1990s.
Can you tell us who you are?
Jack Martin, Federation for American Immigration Reform. I remember back to the 1990s in San Diego when we discussed your ruminating about at what point do we prosecute against recidivism of people reentering the country illegally. And I'm very pleased that the administration right now is continuing the program, the pilot program, basically, of prosecuting illegal entrants at the border, even though it's the first time they've come into the country, and finding great success in that. But, of course, you'd also want to know how many times that person has come into the country. And that's a question I've put to Chief Aguilar on several occasions over the years as to when the Border Patrol is going to know, is going to be able to distinguish between the number of apprehensions and the number of people apprehended because of the fact that you can identify recidivism on the basis of fingerprinting. And the question is, when are we going to reach that point? Because he has always said we're very close but not there yet. Also, just related to that, I'm wondering if in that program on the border and the deportation of people who have entered the country illegally, if some of those people are found reentering the country and what is happening to them then.
I think actually we should continue this discussion because the technological capacity to identify people by fingerprints has grown enormously. And we can give you a pretty good estimate of the number of separate individuals who have been entering the country. And part of the databases that I referred to in my remarks, part of this massive database is actually being able to identify when people have entered illegally, how many times they've tried to enter, where they've tried to enter. When three of us started this in the early 1990s, Border Patrol didn't have the ability to record identities. That was part of the effort of those years. The first time I went to the border, Border Patrol agents were maintaining shoeboxes filled with 3x5 cards, and they would write down the name. And of course, they were not given the real names of the people they were apprehending. When you're apprehended today, we can tell you whether you've tried to cross, if you've been in Tucson, whether you've been in El Paso the week before, or San Diego the week before that. And the second point is that yes, we believe very strongly in consequence delivery. The need to uphold the rule of law by delivering a consequence for breaking the law. And we're doing that in Arizona now for 9 out of 10 cases of people being arrested for illegal entry. They are facing a consequence. Either they're being taken in by the Interior Repatriation Program that John Morton, I think, talked to you about, the MERP program, or they're being taken to the extremes east or west of our border, or they're being prosecuted by Streamline, or they're being processed for expedited removal. But yes, everybody is facing a consequence. And yes, as you come in the second or third or fourth time, you are more likely to be set for prosecution. And the U.S. attorneys are more likely to accept that case. So I take your point. And we are equipped now to be able to distinguish between first-time crossers and people who have tried on numerous occasions.
I think I saw a hand over here, yeah. Here, this.
Hi, I'm Lena Graber with the National Immigration Forum, and my question is about the way enforcement is done. All around the country, local police make traffic stops and call Border Patrol to act as interpreters during those stops whenever someone is not fluent in English. And the effect of this is to rapidly turn into an immigration investigation. And my question is that a CBP policy, and is that what you called serious and sensible law enforcement or an effective use of federal resources?
Well, it depends. There are places in the country, mostly contiguous to the border. We don't. You typically wouldn't find in the center of the country Border Patrol agents responding to police calls. But in the border states, you would see that, and in contiguous states. But it's not a this is not, we don't have people who are just waiting to be called by local police to translate. And in fact, when there are interior enforcement actions, there are criteria that govern this in a sensible way, and we're cooperating very closely with immigration and customs enforcement agents to make judgments, who ultimately make the judgments about when we come across someone, how they are to be treated. Interior enforcements are a part of this, a part of the overall enforcement scheme, but we don't. We have relatively few resources in terms of the Border Patrol directed to that activity, and that's mostly done in support and in conjunction with ICE agents, not as an exclusive service to local law enforcement. So your question suggested, for example, in Chicago, you wouldn't find Border Patrol agents, or in New York, Border Patrol agents coming to translate.
I think I saw. Do you have your hand up? Okay. But before you ask your question, while the mic is coming, I want to pick up on that point about ident and fingerprint information, because that may be being used internally. Obviously, it is being used internally for operational reasons, but I don't think there's any release of that. I don't think we have any way of knowing publicly what those data over the years show about apprehensions vis-a-vis people, and that has been a classically important issue and distinction, and I hope that at some point the Border Patrol is able to be transparent about that data.
Well, and I think as then Chief Aguilar, now Deputy CBP Commissioner Aguilar, said, it's something that we can work toward, but I'm certain that we're closer to it than we were when you
we are closer, when you used which is to why, ask that which question. Is why I'm pressing you that it is the kind of information that ought to be in the public discussion.
Yeah, I will make inquiry on that. I'm not certain why that information wouldn't be useful to the overall debate.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes,
Commissioner Merson, you said, I think, in the
summer. Tell us who you are.
Oh, I'm sorry, Michael Daugherty, Raytheon. You said, I think, over the summer that the days of mom and pop smuggling were over, and I think probably everybody in the room would be kind of distressed with the trend towards transnational gangs and DTOs now running people with all the risk that's involved, maybe a little bit more violent, certainly more exploitive. So when it comes to human trafficking plus smuggling, is there any sort of special technique that you guys are looking at CBP or any kind of answer to dealing with that sort of issue specifically?
First, you're right.
I'm going to tell you that we're basically out of time, and we know you've got to go, so we're going to let you have a short answer.
I'll be happy to make it brief, which is, yes, you need a professional guide to get across the country illegally into the United States now. And the cost of smuggling, I'm told, is up to $3,000 minimally per person. Second is, we see increasingly transnational criminal organizations of being engaged in alien smuggling in ways that was not the case before. There used to be a distinction between drug smugglers and alien smugglers, and we're seeing much more confluence and coincidence than we have. which means that we now use many of the techniques of dealing with alien smuggling that we did with narcotic smuggling. The intelligence approach, the prosecutorial approach, is now much closer than it was in the past, because we begin to see the transnational criminal organizations are what we're confronting and what we need to defeat.
Well, as I said, I'm sorry, but our time is at an end, and even if the commissioner did want to stay, he's due somewhere, and I promised we would make it possible for him to get there. So let me just close by thanking you so much. We really have only scratched the surface, as we know. There are so many questions, and so I hope that there will be another opportunity to continue the conversation. Thanks very much for
Thanks,
being with
Doris.
Us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.